One of my favorite things about science fiction is that it takes your mind out of our normal world. And throughout the ages, the human mind has come up with astounding stories. The goal of this podcast is to give you a taste of some amazing stories written in an older time.
This is Adam Tagaro, and I present to you Yesterday's Sci-Fi. Never had the mind of man conceived so horrible a doom as was reaching for Earth. Never had a greater need for Earth's valiant champions been needed. And yet the only ones who could fight the menace were five futile humans, prisoners on another world. Juggernaut of Space, by Ray Cummings, published in fall of 1945. This will be part one of a two-part podcast for this story. My name is Robert Rance. You've heard of me, of course, through the recent weird affair of the Crimson Comet, if for nothing else. It seems to me rather ironic. For 5 years I have been reporting popular science items on the split wave band of non-visual broadcasting, station WANA NYC, the main outlet of the Amalgamated Newscasters Association for whom I work. I struggled for personal publicity. Then I was plunged, certainly entirely against my will, into the blood-chilling, gruesome adventure which is now popularly known as the Death of the Crimson Comet. Out of it has come publicity beyond my wildest dreams, and now that I've got it, I don't want it. I'm not a hero of dauntless, fearless courage. I'm not a scientific genius who has made possible to Earth the new era of interplanetary travel. But I've been called all that by broadcasting asses who are my friends. I'm just a plain American who, when his life is in danger, gets frightened as the devil, fighting to get himself out of a jam, and with not much thought of anything else. I didn't relish that Crimson Comet business, and I don't ever want to experience anything like it again. I'm not alone in this. There were four others in it with me. They don't like all this public fuss being made over them any more than I do. They weren't heroic. They just tried their best not to get killed. So on their behalf, and my own, I'm writing this narrative of exactly what happened to us, not the professionally glamorized version which you've heard so many times, just the facts. The thing must have been brewing undercover for many months, like a smoldering, unnoticed fire. No one knows. We can only guess at what had happened. But looking back on it now, there were incidents, seemingly unrelated at the time, which now I can see were significant. The first of them was in August 1985, about a year ago. I had just finished a broadcast on some trivial popular science subject, which I had tried to make sound important to my listeners, and Dr. Johns of the White Mountains Observatory telephoned me. I knew him quite well. He had often steered me into little subjects for my broadcasts, but this, I could see at once, was something different. The telegrid showed his thin face without its usual smile. His gray hair was rumpled, his eyes bloodshot. He looked as though he hadn't slept for much too long. "I thought you might want to come up and see me, Bob," he suggested. "Sure I will. I always appreciate your tips, Dr. Johns." His smile was queer. "I haven't got anything, not that you can use," he said. "Certainly not yet. I guess I just figure I'll feel better talking about it. When can you arrive?" "I'll come right away," I told him. "Not busy tonight. I'll be there by midnight." We disconnected. I was just about to leave when Shorty Dirk walked in on me. Shorty was, and still is, connected with the American Newsprint Publishers, a reporter in the crime division, specializing in reporting the work of the Bureau of Missing Persons. He and I were good friends, perhaps because we are so different. I'm big and rangy, slow-going and easy-tempered. In college, I was a good athlete. But now this radio work was putting quite a bit of soft poundage on me which didn't belong. Poundage which, I do assure you, the Crimson Comet business got rid of in a hurry. Like all of us five, I was something like an undernourished greyhound when we got back. Shorty isn't much over 5.5 feet, thin and wiry and alert. A sort of little human dynamo, a freckle-faced fellow with a shock of bristly red hair and a good-natured grin. "Where you going?" he asked. I told him. "I'll go with you," he said. He grinned. "I'm only here, Bob, because I haven't got anything better to do." We took my small flyer from the roof stage and headed north. It was a handsome night, warm and almost cloudless, with the upper air so clear that the stars were packed solid on the purple-blue vault of the heavens. Shorty and I didn't theorize, during the brief trip up to the White Mountains, on what Dr. Johns might have to say. Shorty wasn't much interested in astronomy anyway. To him, as he often said, it was an uninteresting enigma. He mentioned that tonight. "Good," I said. "Then how is crime coming? How many people missing lately?" Things were dull, he assured me. Nothing but the usual run of stuff that you couldn't write up or broadcast because nobody but a few relatives were interested. As it happened, the Crimson Comet affair caused 5 mysterious disappearances. Shorty, myself, and 3 others. I think I can understand now why it happened that I knew them all. I must have been marked through my widely broadcast popular science. That involved Shorty, because he was so much with me. And as for the other 3, looking back on it now, I realize that each of them vanished soon after having been with me. I was being trailed and was seized at last. We landed on the private stage of the big observatory about midnight, and presently were with Dr. Johns in his study. What he had to tell us didn't seem very startling at the time, but in the light of what was to happen, looking back on it now, I can see its deadly significance. Like a great pattern of evil, to involve disaster and death to all the world. Grim, stealthy events creeping upon us, little things here on Earth just involving me and those few others, and with them, giant events mysteriously taking place out in the great vault of the stars. "Here at the observatory," Dr. Johns was saying, "we thought that somehow we must be making miscalculations, a fraction of a second in the axial or orbital movements of the Earth, which involved the visual movement of all the star field. But we checked and rechecked, and then other observatories reported it." The Earth's axial rotation and its movement around the sun apparently were changing infinitesimally. "Too bad," Shorty commented. "I'm sure sorry." But Dr. Johns didn't smile. "There seem to be many unrelated things," he said. "You can shrug any of them off. But then, if it once occurs to you that they might be connected..." "What other things?" I asked. Meteorologists were admitting that the weather was peculiar. Nothing which had not occurred before, of course. Unusual freakish storms in many parts of the Earth. "And for a month now," Dr. Johns went on, "there has been noticeable a peculiar purple radiance in the air at night."
"Purple radiance?" Shorty echoed. "Hadn't noticed it."
"Because it isn't visible to the naked eye," Dr. Johns retorted. "But it has disturbed the exposure time of our photographic work, slowed it down, and our spectrograms show it. Or at least they show its effects so that we know if we could see it, it would be a purplish glow." And there was a new comet which several of the observatories recently had located. I had heard that much, had mentioned it in one of my broadcasts. "We call it a comet," Dr. Johns explained, "because there's a crimson radiance streaming back from it as it comes in toward the sun. But its nucleus seems sizable, 500 miles in diameter possibly, a planetoid with a radiance. You might just possibly call it that." "And it's just about now crossing the orbit of Mars," I said. "That was the last report made public, wasn't it?" Dr. Johns nodded. "Our calculations of its orbit, made a month ago, showed it would pass within about 20 million miles of Earth. But that's all changed now. It's erratic." I was beginning to see why he was startled. This new crimson comet wasn't obeying the normal laws of celestial mechanics. It was swimming erratically in space. Could it be a solid body as big as 500 miles in diameter? Solid enough to be the cause, by its proximity, of the Earth's axial and orbital disturbances? "And this purple radiance," Dr. Johns said soberly. "We've just been wondering if that could be coming from the comet." I need not specify all the weird theories that Dr. Johns and I talked of that evening. With me, a broadcaster of popular science as lurid always as I could make it, weird, gruesome theories came natural. But with him, a man of cold logic and careful science, well, it must have been a premonition. Was this crimson comet hurling a lethal radiance at us, attacking the Earth? A tiny inhabited world of diabolic science enabling it to direct its own course through space, peopled with weird enemies coming at us now, bent on destroying us? You couldn't make such speculations public. People would laugh. But some wouldn't. Some would believe you and go into a wild panic. And Dr. Johns had sent for me, a sort of kindred spirit in the concocting of wild tales. "You two say nothing of this," he warned us. "And if it goes on, you can announce it, Bob." He shrugged again and tried to laugh lugubriously. I feel like an idiot talking about the end of the world with a couple of news hounds, and yet somehow I also feel that maybe every one of us on Earth is in more deadly danger than he ever was before. And we certainly were. That was the general gist of our talk that night with Dr. Johns. I never found out more from him. I had no time. The thing struck at me 4 days later. During those 4 days, it happened that quite by chance I met the three other people who were destined to be plunged with Shorty and myself into adventure. The first was Peter Mack. I was walking at night in Washington Square in New York City, small remaining tradition of little old New York. To me, it's like a monk's garden, flowered, tree-lined rectangle enclosed by the massive building walls with the canyon of Fifth Avenue running into it. The night was hot and clear. The little tent of blue over the square was star-filled. I chanced to sit down for a moment on the bench. "Got a light?" There was a young fellow on the bench with me. He shifted toward me. He was a thin, lanky fellow about my own age, hatless, with the starlight on his sparse, rumpled, sandy hair. A slack-jawed fellow with shabby clothes. He had a grimy cigarette butt between his fingers. "I can do better than that," I smiled. I gave him a cigarette and lighted it for him. "Thanks." He would have turned away, but I stopped him. I don't know why, but there seemed to be something about him that was likable. He needed a shave badly. His clothes were torn. I had a look at his eyes, red-rimmed, bloodshot. Just a down-and-outer on a park bench. But you don't see many of them these days. "Maybe you haven't got a job," I said. "I can tell you a dozen places, easy work, too, in case you're a stranger in town." "I'm not," he said. "Thanks for the cigarette. I'm just minding my own business." I shrugged, and as he gave me a resentful look and shifted back to his own end of the bench, I let him alone. I now know a lot of things that were the matter with Peter Mack, but he has asked me not to go into details. It isn't important anyway. Resentfulness at a girl, the escape mechanism of too much drink, trouble with the authorities in a lot of minor ways, and then a sort of sullen resentment at everything and everybody. A derelict who could salvage himself, but he didn't want to. Anyway, that was Peter Mack. And then there was Vivian Lamar. I met her backstage at the Gaiety with Shorty, who was there to see the stage manager who was to be a witness in some trivial crime affair that Shorty was reporting. This Vivian Lamar was the main reason why the Gaiety was having trouble with the Anti-Vice League and was about to lose its license. She came up to me backstage, a lush, artificial blonde, heavy with makeup, with an amazing expanse of flesh smooth as satin, and a negligible, tinseled costume that the Anti-Vice League did not like at all, but which pleased the Gaiety's customers very much.
"You're Robert Rance," she said. "I saw your picture, and wasn't you televised a few times?"
I agreed that was so.
"I also heard one of your astronomy lectures," she added with a wry grimace. "I was wondering how a guy like that could live with himself."
She looked me up and down.
"Now I see you ain't so bad," she said.
She was grinning. "Much obliged," I said. "Maybe I can teach you astronomy sometime."
"From you I would be glad to learn anything," she retorted, mockingly.
We were standing by the stage door where it was cooler, and a moment later she was called back onto the stage. That was Vivian Lamar. The other person who was destined to be involved with us was J. Walter Blaine, the international financier. I interviewed him at his Fifth Avenue club. He tells me now that I may say what I like concerning my impression of him that first time I met him, so I will be absolutely frank. A man of multi-millions and international importance makes many friends, and inevitably many enemies. Seldom can he know what people really think of him. His enemies exaggerate the worst, and his friends mostly fawn. Blaine's personal reputation, by hearsay, had reached me, of course.
I had no expectation of liking him, and very frankly I didn't. I found him a big man, as tall as myself, heavy, portly, from easy living. But I must say his appearance was impressive. A big mane of shaggy hair, a rather handsome, large-featured face, keen dark eyes under heavy brows, a jutting chin. He was playing chess with a fellow club member, and I sat down to watch. I know something about chess, and I think his playing very well displayed his character. He won, with skill of aggressive attack. But there was about it something you didn't like. His incisive moving of his men, as though there could be no doubt that it was the correct move, and his whole attitude made you hope it wasn't. It was a quite informal game. Once Blaine made an obvious, rather silly mistake, exposing a piece, his opponent offered to have him take it back. He didn't. He pretended it was what he wanted to do, taking the loss rather than admit his error. Then he was finished and turned to me. I was there to interview him for the editor of a booklet being issued by the Royal Astronomical Society of London. It seems that the society was issuing a booklet with little character sketches of the people from whom they had obtained donations, sort of a tribute of thanks. I was commissioned to write the one on Blaine.
"Did they tell you how much I gave them?"
he demanded of me now. I shook my head. "No," I said. His smile was ironic.
"I gave them £100. What they wanted and expected was 10,000. So now you'll write something very nice about me, which they'll hope will flatter me, so I'll give them more. Don't bother, young man."
Blaine was a bachelor. My first impression of him was that he was doing some woman a favor by keeping himself in that category. So much for J. Walter Blaine. It was the next night that the weird thing struck at me. I was walking along the edge of the park, alone on my way to the Midtown office of Amalgamated Newscasters. The street was fairly brightly lighted. I recall that there chanced to be no pedestrians near me, just an empty length of gray-white stone pavement in front of me, with the park on one side. And quite suddenly it was as though I had stepped through a black door into nothingness. I could have been stricken blind, yet it was not that, for in another split second I could see a dim red radiance and hear voices. Then I could see the shapes of people, three men and a woman, stumbling like myself on a strange earthy ground here in the red darkness.
"Look! Here comes another one of us!"
It was a terrified man's voice, vaguely familiar.
"My God! It's the handsome astronomer. I know him."
The voice of Vivian Lamar. And then there was Shorty's voice.
"Bob! Bob Rance!"
I could feel him gripping me, and there was the vague outline of his frightened white face at my shoulder.
"Bob! Tell us what happened to all of us."
And Vivian cried,
"Hang on to him. There he goes."
I was trying to speak, but my tongue was thick, my throat dry and congested. Things were dim and hazy in my mind, and I could feel the cool blankness stealing through my muscles. The touch of hands on my arms faded, until at last there was no more sensation. I made one last great effort to bring myself out of the fog. Then I felt myself falling into a soundless blackness. I think I did not quite lose consciousness. I was aware that I had fallen to the earthly ground, with Shorty and Vivian bending over me. My head was roaring. I was bathed in a cold sweat. Then I began to feel better, trying to sit up and Shorty's arm holding me now.
"You all right now, Bob? Can't you speak?"
"Yes, I guess so."
Whatever had happened, which had brought me here when an instant ago, it seemed, I was walking alone by the park, none of us could imagine. The identical experience had happened to Shorty, to Vivian Lamar, and to Peter Mack, and J. Walter Blaine.
"But where are we?" I demanded, when in another moment I was strong enough to struggle upright in the crimson glowing darkness.
"Damned if we know," Shorty said. It seemed a sort of underground grotto. I could begin to make out its rocky walls and ceiling now, with that glow like a crimson phosphorescence streaming from them. One by one my companions had found themselves here. Blaine was the first. Then, at intervals, it seemed as though the wall across the grotto had opened and Shorty, Vivian, and Mac came stumbling in, standing an instant, dazed and then falling as I had fallen, almost in a normal faint.
"No way of getting out of this damn place," Shorty was saying. "The rock wall over there moves like a door, but we haven't been able to open it."
How much time had passed since we were stricken with this weird thing, none of us could guess. Suddenly I was startled. My clothes were too big for me. My body felt thin. I had lost 20 or 30 pounds.
and in the dim crimson glow now I could see Mac, Vivian, and Blaine fairly well. All of them thinner than I remembered them, with faces drawn and haggard, and big glowing, smoldering eyes. And we men had a growth of beard. Weeks could have passed. Vivian laughed lugubriously as she met my startled stare. "Deglamorized," she said. "I feel like a lost alley cat." She was clad in a thin summer street dress. Her lush lissome curves were gone so that it hung drably on her. The vivid artificial blonde hair was darkish at the roots. It fell in a tangled mass to her shoulders. Her makeup was gone, her lips pallid. "We're all about starved to death, if you ask me," she added. "He brought us food a while ago," Blaine put in. "Try to eat it," Mac said. "There's some of it over by the wall. If that's what we've been living on, no wonder we're starved." "He? Food?" I stammered. Since Blaine had found himself here, what seemed like perhaps 12 hours had passed. Our captor had come twice. They had only seen him dimly. "But he's human, semi-human anyway," Shorty said, "and he seems to talk English a little." "Look," Vivian suddenly murmured, "here he comes again." The red glow across the cave for an instant brightened. It seemed as though a rock had slid aside and closed again. A dim, upright shape moved toward us, stopped and stood regarding us with eyes that gleamed green, smoldering in the dimness.
"The great mind. Ready. See you soon,"
the figure's weird, guttural voice said. I moved forward, unsteadily on my feet. "I want to talk to you," I said. I could see him now quite plainly. A man? I suppose you could call him that. He was about 5 feet tall, squat and square with high square shoulders, a rectangular torso and two legs which seemed encased in a flexible metal gray fabric. His head was round, set upon a triangular neck with its apex under the chin. A bullet head, hairless, with a weird box-like face, square-chinned and broad square nose. His two arms, long and powerful-looking, dangled at his sides. This, we were soon to learn, was Radic. I recall my first clear impression that there was about him a queer sense of power, and something else, mysterious, yet even more apparent. An automaton-like quality. It was as though here were an individual who was only acting his role as a tiny part of some great organized thing, a cog in the machine. The German Nazis of my father's boyhood must have been like that. And here, with these Radics of the Crimson Comet, it seemed intensified to be almost gruesome. You could not tell why, but you could sense it. Human individuals who lived only to do what they were told. A great mental force dominating them from birth to death, so that they thought what they were told to think, only did what they were told to do. This Radic answered our questions now. He seemed willing enough to talk, though in many ways his knowledge of our language, newly absorbed by his weird brain, was inadequate. I think it best to summarize briefly here the total of what we learned and saw of this strange little world and its people. In actuality, we were destined to see very little. Doomed little world. And since its death now, as you all know, most of its secrets will forever remain a mystery. It was some 500 Earth miles in diameter, doubtless of immense density, because we were not aware of much change of gravitational force. Of its past history, no one knows much. Somewhere out in interplanetary space, it must have once had a normal orbit. I shall explain more of that later. Two human races were here now. The Radics, there were perhaps something like 1,000 or 2 of them, were the rulers. The others were the Lay, a primitive gentle people, no more than slaves to the dominating Radics. Nature always had been cruel, uncompromising here on Xelos, which was the word their native language seemed to call their world. Both Radics and Lay lived always in great underground caverns, with which this section of the surface was honeycombed. Above them, on the outer surface, weird storms and erratic extremes of heat and cold were prevalent. And out there, strange monsters roamed, the deathless things, as they were called, since it was impossible to kill them. Creatures of indescribable, horrible quality, who seemed unwilling to come into the confines of the underground corridors and grottos, so that all the humans were of necessity driven here, eking out a drab and grim existence. How the strange science of the Radics developed will forever remain a mystery. Perhaps it was brought here from some other planet. Despite the science, life here was primitive, a struggle for the bare necessities.
Queerly enough, the Radic science seemed not concerned with better living. They had a few small space flyers. The secret of interplanetary travel was known to them. Perhaps only recently, that seems rather certain. Beyond that, there was nothing save the weird, mysterious mechanisms by which, at last, they had been able to control the space movements of their tiny world. It was all here, in what they called the Great Cavern of Machines. Shorty and I were there for a brief time, an unforgettable time of horror. "The Great Mind will see us soon?" I was saying now to this Radic, who stood stiff and stolid beside me. What is that? We were soon to see. Another Radic appeared, motioning us imperiously to follow him. Neither of these fellows seemed to have any weapons on them, though of course there was no way of telling. Shorty nudged me, muttering something about starting a fight.
"You're crazy," I whispered. "We'll be killed." "The Great Mind won't see you now,"
one of the Radics said. He led us, and we followed him, with the other Radic behind us, out into a dim rock corridor gleaming with that same crimson phosphorescence. The banker, Blaine, pushed past me. "I'll attend to this," he said. "This ruler, whoever he is, can be bought. I'll get him to take us back to Earth. Promise him riches." The ragged, cadaverous Mac gave Blaine a glance of contempt. "I guess it's strange to you, not being able to buy everything with your money, isn't it?" he commented. A distant murmur of voices sounded ahead of us now, and we could see where the light glow widened as the corridor emerged into another grotto. More Radics were around us now, herding us with their stiff, jerky movements, jabbering with their strange guttural voices. The murmur ahead of us grew louder, and then we emerged from the tunnel. It was at first almost like being above ground, a huge grotto with red glowing ceiling high up, dim in the crimson haze. To the sides, the precipitous rock walls widened rapidly out. Ahead of us, down a ragged, undulating slope, there was only a red haze of distance. There seemed to be distant fields with things growing in them. There was a spindly blue and red stalk-like vegetation growing like trees, perhaps to a height of 100 feet. And off to the left, under the trees, there were mound-shaped little buildings. We were on a broad, level space at the top of the slope. 100 or more Radics were here, some crowding at us, but most standing stiff, gazing at us with gleaming animal-like eyes. And now I saw Radic women and children among them. The women, broader-hipped, narrower-shouldered, but they were all cast in the same mold. Even the children stood at attention, like rows of little statues waiting for something to move them, with only their eyes in motion. Most of the murmuring voices were further down the slope. A crowd of figures milled about, down there, trying to see us better. 1,000, perhaps. The Lay, the slaves of this little world. Certainly they seemed far more human than the Radics, slim and slight, and some of them as tall as Shorty. They were dressed in simple, flowering fabric garments. A bronze-skinned people, the women with long, flowing hair.
"You come this way,"
the Radic said.
"Now you stand still. The Great Mind speak to you."
Ruler of the Crimson Comet, he sat on a sort of stone throne with a leafy canopy over him. Our captors shoved us forward until we stood in a wavering line, all of us staring blankly at this being whose mentality encompassed and dominated every living human on this tiny world. He looked as though once he had had the aspect of a Radic, but that perhaps was 100 or 200 Earth years ago. He sat now with his shriveled, wrinkled gray body, small as a child, encased in a single garment of woven fabric. His round head, devoid of hair, wobbled on a spindly neck. Skin like shriveled gray parchment covered his shrunken, bony face, giving him a mummy-like appearance of immense age. His shiny, smooth gray skull seemed bloated by the pulsating brain tissue within it. It bulged in places, with worm-like knots under the scalp, dilating, quivering, as his huge green glowing eyes regarded us. Then he spoke, slowly, with a measured sonorous voice of weird sepulchral tone, and what he said, it was as though here we faced a mental power too great to resist, as though there could be no question but that his thoughts must be our thoughts. I felt it with a sudden strange shudder, a radiance of thought from him, beating down, destroying whatever was within me of independent individualism. And the realization swept me. If I yielded to this radiance, these thought waves, whatever they might be, then all that was Robert Rance would be gone.
I would be nothing but an automaton. He was saying, "You will listen. There are things I shall explain to you, Earthmen. I have sent to Earth and brought you here because each of you has a knowledge of many things on Earth that I wish to know." I listened, numbed, somewhat perhaps as though hypnotized. In this Radic ruler's judgment, Blaine the banker, Mac the derelict, Shorty, myself, and Vivian, the sum total of the myriad things that were stacked in our brains, were what now must go into his. Certainly a varied representative strata of Earth knowledge.
"You want to learn everything that we know?" Blaine suddenly said. "How can you do that? Suppose we don't want to teach you. And why do you want to learn it? What are your plans? What I want to know is, do you realize who and what I am on Earth?"
Of us all, undoubtedly, the dominating nature of J. Walter Blaine made him best able to resist that weird mental force that was engulfing us. Yet his manner, his querulous, arrogant questions under these strange, unearthly conditions here on the Crimson Comet certainly were fatuous, childish. Mac gave a short, disagreeable laugh. "On Earth, okay," Mac muttered, "but you don't amount to much here." "Money, of course, won't mean anything to you," Blaine was saying, "but I'll have other things on Earth. Things that you would want. Look here, if you send all these people away, I'll have a talk with you. I'll..." He got no further. It seemed that a look of wonderment was upon the shriveled ancient gray face. The eyes were darting little green fires. The measured voice said, "I shall attend to you later," and then droned into the Radic tongue. Four of the squat little men marched upon Blaine, seizing him.
"What in the devil? Stop that!" Blaine remonstrated.
There was a scuffle beginning. I recall that I shouted,
"Blaine, take it easy, you'll be killed!"
Amazing power of these squat little men. A claw-like hand was clapped over Blaine's mouth. His flailing arms and kicking legs were pinned by the Radic's clutches. And then they picked him up and carted him away.
"I shall begin with you, Peter Mac," the Radic ruler said quietly. "Come forward. Bend before me."
For a second, Mac hesitated, flinging Shorty and me a questioning glance, but we had nothing to offer. Then the shabby, lanky figure of the bearded Mac shambled forward, guided by two Radics until he was standing with head bent before the ruler. Down the slope, the murmurs of the crowd of Lay rose into a babble. The milling throng of a slave people 100 yards or so from us crowded curiously forward to see Mac better. There was a sudden low-voiced command from the Radic ruler. A dozen or more of the squat gray Radics ran at the Lay, cuffing them, knocking them back. I saw a young Lay girl, slim, with flowing white and tawny hair framing her face. The little automaton Radic ran at her, struck her in the mouth so that the blood spurted out. And through it all, near me a row of Radic children stood stiffly at attention, motionless, with only their round green eyes turning sideways to watch the scene. Then the ancient Radic ruler's smoldering gaze was upon Mac's head. An odd silence fell over the scene as Mac stood motionless. Who shall say by what weird and gruesome process Mac was now being sapped? No one on Earth knows what a thought is. No one can say what is within our brain cells to constitute knowledge. But something is there, something in our conscious and subconscious minds upon which our memory can draw. And we do know that thought is a wave of vibration, an infinitely tiny, infinitely rapid vibration, a thing that at least has a tangible entity. And this Radic's mind now was drawing, sapping from Mac. 1 minute. 5 minutes. In the tense silence, I felt Shorty clutch at me, heard him mutter, "God, it's weird." Mac now was drooping, a mental agony rasping his nerves now, drawing vitality from him so that he drooped, swayed, and suddenly let out a groan. Mental anguish, with screaming nerves translating it into physical pain.
"It's torture," Vivian murmured. "Look at him. Stop it. Stop it."
Mac had fallen to the ground, writhing now, mumbling with futile hands clawing at his face and head as though to pluck away this damnable, torturing gaze. But still, calmly, inexorably, the green-eyed, monstrous little Radic held him, this shriveled Radic ruler, avidly, greedily drawing in the knowledge of Mac's past life, those myriad little things of Earth life stored within Mac's brain. Surely it must have been a torture most horrible. Shorty and I were starting to leap forward in protest, but Vivian was ahead of us, raging, rushing heedlessly at the old Radic. She almost reached him. She was screaming, "You rotten damn thing, you—" Her hand went up to strike him. It was all a sudden chaos, just a few seconds. Radix caught Shorty and me. With almost machine-like strength, their arms pinned us. I think I yelled at Shorty not to struggle. In that same second, I saw Vivian's arm with clenched fist trying to hit the Radic ruler, but a little squat gray figure standing guard there jumped and seized her. It was an amazing tableau. At the threatened blow, the ruler shrank back. His whole little body quivered, pulsated, and on the weird, almost unhuman face, there was a look. Not of fear, but of strange revulsion. As though the threat of that physical blow were something too horrible to contemplate.
"Vivian! Vivian, you... They'll kill you! Run, Vivian, run!"
Mac was staggering to his feet, stumbling, half-falling, but he reached Vivian, clutched her. Both of them were confused, dazed so that all they could do was stand there, holding on to each other. I saw Mac gazing defiantly at the oncoming Radix. Mac, who on Earth probably wouldn't have lifted a hand to help anyone, ready now to fight to protect this girl.
"You will all stand away from them." It was the ruler's quiet, measured voice. And abruptly I saw that his shriveled hand had gone to his belt. A weapon was hanging there, a little pot-bellied black cylinder. His fingers shifted it, seemed aiming it at Vivian and Mac. Shorty and I were struggling, but the Radix held us, and we were both shouting. Then there was a soundless, almost invisible flash, just a vague spitting glow of light from the little cylinder. It leaped, and for a second clung upon Mac and the girl. They seemed to stiffen. Just that, nothing else. Still clutching each other, they stood transfixed, and on their faces there was a blankness, a strange emptiness. "You will walk together hand in hand." The ruler's soft voice was droning. "One of my Radix will lead you to the upper exit, and then you will walk together alone, out into the realm of the deathless things."
He added something in his own language. A little Radix moved in front of Mac and Vivian now. Hand in hand they were standing docile, and then they were following the Radix, following him with slow, measured steps, their faces blank, their eyes staring straight ahead of them, like somnambulists walking in their sleep.
"Good Lord," Shorty murmured. "That could be the way we are abducted on Earth. Do you suppose—"
His words were cut off. The ruler had given another command. The Radix gripping us were pulling us away, shoving us back into the dim crimson tunnel from which they had brought us. I turned to look behind me. The stiff figures of Mac and Vivian were still visible, walking in a trance, following the square, box-like Radix who marched silently ahead of them. For a moment they wound along the edge of the slope, then the crimson murk of the radiance enveloped them, and they were gone. Roughly, Shorty and I were shoved along the tunnel by our captors. Then a rock panel slid aside. We were shoved in, and the panel slid closed.
"Well," Shorty murmured, "that's that. We're in a jam, Bob. A damn weird jam."
It was soundless in here, and darker than out in the main open grotto. But still there was that dim crimson glow. We were in a small cave cell now. The air was hot, fetid, earthy. Presently we could see a little better. There was nothing but black spongy ground, glowing red rock walls, and a rock ceiling close over us. In the dimness I fumbled, feeling the wall, trying to find the crevice of the sliding door panel, but could not. Time passed. Shorty and I both realized now that we were weak and faint from hunger. Not altogether the hunger from missing a meal or so, but the depletion of long undernourishment. Together we lay down on the fibrous ground. I think at that moment I was more despairing than ever before in my life. I seemed unable to cope with even the thought of what we might possibly plan. I closed my eyes. I seemed to just want to drift into the blessed relief of sleep.
"This is one jam we might not get out of, Bob," Shorty murmured presently.
"Yes, it looks so." Then suddenly both of us were galvanized into alertness. The door panel was sliding open, with a little rasp and an influx of brighter red glow. Outside in the corridor, we saw a group of Radix on guard, but none of them came in. They moved aside and a figure came past them. A lay girl. Her slim body was draped in a bluish garment of thatch. Her long, tawny hair flowed down over her shoulders. She was carrying a slab on which there was food and drink for us. Then she set the slab on the ground near us, She was between us and the door, almost a silhouette, but I could see that her hand was at her lips and her glowing eyes seemed warning us to be silent. For an instant, she leaned close toward me.
I am Tan, the wife of Taro, the Lay.
Her voice barely whispered it.
You say nothing. I come again with Taro's plan to help you. We would save you and your earth if we can.
Silent, Shorty and I just stared. Then she had turned and was gone. The rock panel slid closed upon us.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yesterday's Sci-Fi. This has been part one of two of Juggernaut of Space by Ray Cummings, published in fall of 1945. Let's find out next week what happens all the way in the future of 1986. For all things Yesterday Sci-Fi, head on over to yesterdayssci-fi.com or hit me up on Twitter @yesterdayssci-fi. This has been Adam Tagaro reading Yesterday's Science Fiction to you.